This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Ethnic federal system is inherently volatile because you have regions based on ethnicity that create centrifugal forces within society.
That's Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, pointing out one of the causes of the problems plaguing Ethiopia. Details coming up. Also, Nigeria is experiencing its worst economic crisis in a generation, and South Korea vows to expand ties with African nations. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Africa's ruling African National Congress, the ANC, is discussing several options aimed at establishing a stable, functional government within the next 12 days. It has been talking to all political parties over the past few days after receiving only 40% of the vote in last week's election. Darren Taylor reports.
The African National Congress has met with most major opposition parties over the past few days. At a news briefing Wednesday, party spokesperson Mahlengi Bengu Motsiri said the goal was to create a government that ensures national unity and stability. The party, which has led South Africa for 30 years, faces a choice. Go right by partnering with the business-friendly Democratic Alliance, the DA, or swing left by forming a coalition government with two parties, former President Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto weSizwe Party, the MK, and Julius Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF. The DA favours conservative economic policies and a free market, which it says will encourage investors and lift millions out of poverty. It wants an end to key ANC policies, including black economic empowerment, which it says has only enriched a small elite, and it wants to privatize services such as electricity and water. VOA has seen an ANC discussion document that suggests an option of forming a government with the DA, which would give the ANC control of the executive, while the DA would control parliament. This irks senior ANC official Lindiwe Sisulu, who calls the DA an arrogant white party.
Why do we need to be monitored? The system that we have right now works very perfectly. We have our own system in which we account to our people. We don't need a class monitor from the DA. Why would we take one party that is so ideologically at odds with ourselves? They have a privileged background that they can fall back on. We have years and years of underprivileged people that we have to cover for. Why would we choose a DA? We're willing to compromise on many things, but we're not willing to compromise on the DA agenda. We have many black parties in parliament, and together we are able to form the necessary majority that is required by the constitution.
Some analysts say the ANC was punished at the polls because it hasn't been helping poor South Africans and has enriched itself through alleged corruption. Sisulu is part of a faction that supports an agreement with MK and possibly the EFF. Those parties want to change the constitution to allow the state to control all wealth, including land, banks and mines, and share the profits with the poor. However, some business leaders and political analysts say those policies could collapse the economy. Bengu Motsiri on Wednesday said the ANC has had talks with the DA, the EFF and other parties. She says the MK leadership has not responded to an invitation to meet. MK says it'll consider partnering with the ANC only if President Cyril Ramaphosa resigns. The ANC says he's staying. Top DA sources have told VOA they want Ramaphosa to remain, but they want some of their officials as cabinet ministers, which at this stage the ANC opposes. DA leader John Stiernason told VOA his party hopes to begin talks with two other parties, including the ANC, on Thursday.
I mean, it's going to be completely about give and take and about what flexible positions you're able to put on the table. Right now for us, this is an exercise in harvesting the options to see what the other parties are putting on the table, how far they're prepared to go. So apart from some very strong red lines around excluding MK and EFF, who we regard as anti-constitutionalists, well, we are going into them with an open mind and open hand to parties who share the values of respect for the rule of law and the constitution, building an economy.
MK and EFF say they will not accept a coalition between the ANC and DA, and they warn of undefined consequences should this happen. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United States ambassador to Ethiopia, Irvin Masinga, recently gave a speech blaming all the armed ethnic actors in the country for inflicting human suffering. He urged fighters from those factions to make their demands through dialogue rather than violence. To those who govern Ethiopia, he added, the country has far more to gain through peace than on the battlefield. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, points out to me that one of the major causes for the civil wars in Ethiopia is the government's adherence to the volatile concept of ethnic federalism.
Well, Ethiopia continues to face tensions surrounding its system of government, which has been based on ethnic federalism, instituted under the previous government some 30 years ago after the ousting of the longtime dictatorship of the Mengistu regime. And the ethnic federal system is inherently volatile because you have regions based on ethnicity that create centrifugal forces within society, and so are pushing these regions outward and are really incentivizing, encouraging the most vociferous views based on ethnicity to provide leadership and direction in those regions. And it's that has been the basis, that has been the foundation of a series of conflicts that we've seen in Ethiopia, most notably the Tigray conflict, where the region of Tigray was declaring its autonomy and independence. And we're seeing similar tensions at a lower scale with the Amhara region and the Oromo region. Each of these regions has their own ethnic militias. And so effectively, what we've been seeing is the federal government and Addis pushing politically and in some cases militarily, coercively, to keep the country of Ethiopia, this multi-ethnic federal system, together. And, you know, this is the overall state of Ethiopia when we look at it in a big picture in terms of what's happening, and it's managing those tensions that really have been the challenge and have resulted in the security crises that we've seen in recent years. A lot of the tensions we've seen between the federal government and the ethnic militia called Fano are about that, about, you know, whether ethnic militias can continue in this next chapter of Ethiopia's history. You know, the tensions of trying to keep a multi-ethnic country, a federal structure together, where there are these centrifugal forces trying to pull it apart. That's at the heart of the violence and the human rights abuses that we've seen in Ethiopia.
Moving forward, let's say the culprit could be the ethnic federalism you were talking about. Can that be replaced by maybe an interim arrangement whereby the government engages with the parties to narrow political differences and enable reconciliation and develop a shared understanding and a vision for the people?
I think that's exactly what needs to happen now for Ethiopia, that there needs to be recognition that the ethnic federal system has failed, and there needs to be this national dialogue about what is a new structure that can work more effectively. Ethiopia is a country of 110 million people with multi-ethnic groups, and there's a lot of value in having a more decentralized federal system for the country. The problem is when that's based on ethnicity, because that just incentivizes divisions. You know, every federal system really struggles with that. And so it does require dialogue. It requires contextualization to the realities of Ethiopia. It requires rebuilding trust and good faith. So, you know, it's especially hard to do now that there has been multiple conflicts within Ethiopia. I don't see any other way around it. You know, these tensions have been exposed, and the current political structure just really encourages each of the regions to, you know, further differentiate themselves. And so that's just a recipe for more tension, more division. And so there does need to be more dialogue. And I think there are a number of paths forward where there can be a great deal of decentralization, and local concerns and local interest can be maintained, and people have control over, you know, priorities that matter to them, reaffirming the integrated federal structure of Ethiopia. And so that's the real challenge, you know, giving space and autonomy at the local level while ensuring and incentivizing unification for the state of Ethiopia overall.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking to me by phone from Washington. Ethiopia is experiencing its worst economic crisis in a generation, leading to widespread hardship and anger, and a national strike Monday over the low minimum wage and an electricity surcharge. Some Nigerians are demanding a reversal of government policies 1 year after authorities embarked on bold but unpopular economic reforms. President Bola Tinubu has so far refused to change course, insisting his reforms will improve Nigeria's ailing economy. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
This was how it all began on May 29, 2023, as Bola Tinubu was inaugurated as the 16th president of Africa's most populous nation. Under the campaign Renewed Hope, the so-called political godfather of Lagos promised economic growth, security, job creation, food security, and inclusive leadership. But 1 year later, many Nigerians who supported him, like trader Jolly Guinea Kanwa, say his approach is flawed.
That we are suffering. Tinubu should do something. Tinubu should do something. At least he's a human being. He's a human being. He's the one ruling this country. He did not come to destroy this country, but to take care of the people that is ruling. To take care of us. We are suffering. Children are crying. Adults are crying.
President Tinubu introduced controversial policies, including the scrapping of decades-long fuel subsidy payments and floating the Naira against other world currencies shortly after taking office. Transportation and food prices have soared, leading to an annual inflation rate of 34%. Tinubu has assured Nigerians he'll fix inflation and address the economic challenges. This week, the president announced free train rides for 6 months as he opened a new metro station in Abuja to mark his first year in office. The president also announced the launch of several development projects, but critics say the government is irresponsible and pandering to foreign influence. Ezo Nyegbere is founder of the Center for Social Justice.
It was extremely and fundamentally flawed to stay at the swearing-in ceremony to announce that subsidy is gone. When you had no ministers, no advisors, nobody to talk to, because before you should announce that policy, there should have been some people sitting down in a committee or in a group or whatever you call them, do the simulations and the projections.
Nigeria's security situation is also getting worse under Tinubu. According to Beacon Security Consultant Limited, the number of terrorist and criminal attacks in the last year increased to nearly 8,000 compared to 5,500 recorded the year before. Onyebere says lack of accountability is the reason the security problems have persisted.
Politics is still being trumping governor, especially in security. How many of these bandits have been captured, tried, prosecuted, and sentenced for people to see?
Many here say they will continue to remind the president of his campaign promises to make the country more secure and prosperous. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. South Korea pledges to expand ties with African nations and provide more development aid to the continent. In a speech yesterday at the start of the two-day summit in Seoul, President Yoon Suk-yeol urged African countries to take stronger steps in an international campaign against North Korea, which recently stepped up its tests of nuclear-capable weapon systems. Kwaku Nuema, professor of international politics at American University, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that aside from politics, South Korea is very interested in gaining access to Africa's critical minerals.
South Korea is looking for critical minerals and also markets. So this is the place to go. Africa's market is growing right now. 1.4 billion people by 2050, one out of every four persons on the planet will be in Africa. So this is a growing market. And it's also a very, very important source of critical minerals that South Korea needs for its technology sector, electric cars and artificial intelligence. They are competing against Japan and India and China and the United States. And so it makes a lot of sense to look to Africa.
When you talk about minerals, what kinds of minerals are we talking about?
So we're talking about rare earths. We're talking about critical minerals. So Africa has about 30% of the world's critical minerals, chrome, cobalt, manganese, lithium, nickel, cobalt, graphite, those kinds of stuff, the kind of minerals that are used for semiconductor manufacturing and batteries and particularly electric cars and also solar technology. All those minerals are there. The Chinese kind of have cornered the market on that. They control a lot of it. And so it makes sense for South Korea to be jumping in the fray.
You just kind of outlined the important minerals that are sought after by many countries around the world right now, including the United States. What does these African heads of state, what do they hope to get out of it?
Well, Africans are happy to be courted. It's better to be courted than ignored. And so the African countries that have some of these minerals are looking to add value to them, and they want to entertain foreign investors who may help either develop some of these minerals before they are exported or pay a slightly higher price for it. But these kinds of meetings, it's a grab bag because you have a lot of leaders there. It's about 48 countries represented. They all have different needs, but this is an opportunity for them to talk about other things such as tariff-free access to Korean markets, efforts to attract Korean investment to the continent. Then, of course, in the bilateral sections, each leader will push what is important to their economy. But there's also aid on the agenda. And the Koreans are also trying to kind of counter North Korean efforts to recruit some of these African countries into its orbit as it continues to deal with North Korea as a diplomatic problem.
Some observers might say that this is just yet another country that's, you know, going to go in and take more natural resources out of Africa, and they're just, you know, being selfish about it and looking to enrich themselves at the expense of these African countries. How is South Korea different than other countries that have already gone there, like you mentioned China? How is South Korea different?
Well, South Korea is not different from any other country. Any country that goes into Africa is seeking to advance its interests, and that's okay. These African states are not children. They are sovereign states. They know what's good for them, and they should come to the bargaining table with a list of their own demands. And so to the extent that they've mismanaged prior relationships, we can say those are their own faults, and hopefully they learn from those experiences with China, for example, or the loans that they took out that never led to development, that led to deep indebtedness. They should learn from those things and come to this new engagement with those lessons and make better bargains. But essentially, any country that goes in there has something that it wants, and so do the Africans.
That is Kwaku Nuema, professor of international politics at American University, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam in Washington. A report released yesterday says Hate and extremism in the United States rose in 2023 with record numbers of white nationalists and anti-LGBTQ plus groups trying to undermine the country's inclusive democracy. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias breaks down the researchers' findings and the implications for the November presidential election.
The LGBTQ plus community was one of the primary targets of hate and extremism in the U.S. in 2023, according to a report released Tuesday by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Researchers say hate-filled rhetoric and anti-government conspiracy theories also negatively affected immigrants, people of color, and minority faith communities. R.G. Cravens is a senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
Extremists, those who oppose inclusive democracy, spent the last year legitimizing insurrection, painting hate as virtuous, and transforming conspiracy theories into mainstream narratives. And they're all in preparation, I would say, towards one of the most significant elections in our history.
A total of 835 anti-government groups were active last year, up from 702 the previous year. The report found the number of active hate groups in the U.S. rose to 595 last year, up from 523 in the previous year. Craven says the groups are moving into the political realm with a specific goal.
To limit pluralism, it's to limit participation, it's to limit democracy itself.
U.S. President Joe Biden presents himself as the only viable option in the November presidential election to stop a rise in hate-filled rhetoric.
We're not going to let Donald Trump turn America into a place that doesn't believe in honesty, decency, and treating people with respect. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let Donald Trump turn America into a place filled with anger and resentment and hate.
Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, sparked controversy when, as president, he blamed both sides for violent clashes at a 2017 white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that broke out between protesters and counter-protesters. During the demonstration, a white supremacist intentionally drove his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one woman and injuring more than 30 people. Then-President Trump addressed the violence, calling it an egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. Trump has sided with groups at the forefront of book bans, such as Moms for Liberty, which the Southern Poverty Law Center listed again in 2023 as an anti-government extremist group opposed to inclusive education.
The radical left is even slandering Moms for Liberty as a so-called hate group. You're a hate group. Can you imagine? Moms for Liberty, hate group.
Experts say candidates must be careful about the rhetoric to quell any potential violence ahead of the November general election. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has suspended food deliveries to thousands of displaced households in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as fighting intensifies, forcing more people to flee. Over the past few days, clashes between the M23 rebels and the DRC army moved closer to Kanyabayonga, a strategic town that is home to more than 60,000 people on the northern front of the conflict. The French news agency AFP reports that the ICRC began distributing food to displaced people in Kanyabayonga on May 24th, but was forced to stop 6 days later. The ICRC says families are again moving away from approaching fighting, making them even more vulnerable. On Tuesday, fighting was taking place 5 kilometers south of Kanyabayonga. The clashes had moved to the town on Friday, but local sources told the AFP that the rebels were pushed back. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhaib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.